All right, yeah, thank you for the introduction, and thanks again for inviting me to this wonderful program. I want to tell you today about some of the experience that we have been doing over the past year or so, past 1.5 years or so, and that relates to basically simulating spontaneous emission in a platform that is not usually associated with this kind of phenomenon, so matter waves. Before I start, maybe because I went through this as I prepared for this topic, I want to tell you a little bit about the history of spontaneous emission. We all know about this, that this started with Einstein and so on, but I just want to go through this quickly. So Einstein in 1917 came up with the concept of spontaneous emission, and he was motivated by a paper by Rutherford, where Rutherford described gamma ray decay.
And explain the Germans like quantum theory of
radiation. Quantum theory of radiation. And so he considered an atom in equilibrium with radiation fields. And in order to describe the situation, he came up with three hypotheses. One that that's already the one we are going to use here, that decay and emission of light quantum, it happens without an external cause. Yeah? So this is the A coefficient. And then the incident radiation, which is in equilibrium with the atom, can lead to changes of state through absorption and emission. And so that is the stimulated emission. And then also he postulates, and I think this was the main point of his paper, that the light quantum, which was not called photon yet, has a momentum. And this is the hypothesis. He obtains Planck's law, and he also shows that because of this momentum assumption, that the velocity distribution of the atoms in the gas in equilibrium with the radiation field is a Maxwell distribution. And so he gets full consistency. He wonders a bit that this spontaneous emission must transfer random momentum, so there's randomness in the problem, and he didn't like this concept, but at that time, he still accepted that simply, and so that was the description of spontaneous emission. Now, he gives these coefficients, the A and B coefficient, but he does not discuss what causes actually spontaneous emission. That was left to Dirac 10 years later, who remarks in this paper here that nothing has been done up to now on quantum electrodynamics. Yeah? So the radiation field was basically not treated in a quantum way. And at that time when he wrote this paper, the Bose-Einstein statistics was already out. Yeah? And he develops in this paper a perturbation theory. He quantizes the electromagnetic field and comes up with this Hamiltonian. I guess it's more like a matrix element, but this is the result of his calculations here. So he has absorption piece, stimulated emission, and plus one, and that's the spontaneous emission piece. And in today's language, if you rewrite this, it looks like that is Hamiltonian. So you have the atomic piece, you have the radiation field, and you have the interaction. And this interaction is as a coupling strength, that is now given by the interaction of the dipole matrix element with the zero-point field at a corresponding mode that he's considering. So there's all kinds of modes in the problem, and you have to sum up over those, and then you get these couplings. An elementary process here is that you go from excited state to ground state, and you produce a photon at some momentum, or vice versa. And in this paper, he determines one of the coefficients, not the spontaneous emission. He says basically one should be able to calculate the line widths from this treatment, but he's not doing that in that paper. That was left to a young PhD student at the time, Victor Weisskopf, who was in Göttingen, and he picked a problem that he could work on. He felt very comfortable already with using Schrödinger's equation to solve things. And so one day, Eugen Wigner came by for a visit, and they start talking about this. And so he started to calculate. And yeah, in this paper, it says we solve these equations in a manner differing from the usual one. And so what the usual one was at that point was basically doing perturbation theory and using Fermi's golden rule. And so what he does, he starts with a Dirac Hamiltonian, makes an ansatz that basically the state of the system is that you have either the atom in the excited state and no radiation, no photons in the radiation field, or you have the atom in a ground state and the photon is somewhere, and you sum up over this momentum. And just notice there's a k missing, so this should be dk. So there's amplitudes for each of those possibilities. Okay, so you plug this in, you solve for the amplitude, for example, and you see that the time evolution of the amplitude depends on the integral over its past. But in this paper, they say we should a priori expect an exponential decay. And so how can you get an exponential decay out of here? You take this amplitude and just pull it out of the integral. And nowadays, this is known as the Markov approximation or Weisskopf-Friedmann approximation. Okay, then also you integrate to time t. The decay will happen. It's exponential, so it doesn't make a big difference whether you replace t with infinity. Also, you're considering a continuum, so the sum of the modes you can, or sum of the momenta you can replace by the sum over the energies. And also, there is no negative energy in the emission, so it also doesn't make or create a big problem. At least that's what they say in this paper. If you replace the lower limit of integration with negative infinity in energy, and the result is that you get out a rate here that you can calculate. It's a famous result. You can rewrite this in terms of Fermi's golden rule, and you recover here this coupling d times e. That's now the resonant zero-point field, and then the density of states. Now, in this paper, they basically come to the interpretation, or this was also discussed then, later in many textbooks, that spontaneous emission is caused by zero-point oscillations of the vacuum. So that's basically this term. One should not confuse this with saying the spontaneous emission is caused by zero-point fluctuations, whatever fluctuations mean. So this is not something irregular. This is really a resonant field that oscillates at the corresponding frequency. Now, in this paper, they have a footnote in there where they say it's not really maybe that great to make this replacement down here, because if we don't do this, yeah, we get an imaginary part here. And of course, that is the piece which leads to the lamp shift. And in this paper, they basically say in a footnote that this gamma, this rate, must be replaced by a complex number, and the shape and width of the line remain unchanged, but the line is shifted slightly. And so that was in 1930. And of course, when we think about lamp shift, we think much ahead of time, or much later, 1947. There was this conference on Shelter Island. That's on Long Island here, actually. That's Stony Brook University. Shelter Island is right here, on the foundations of quantum mechanics. And so that was basically a collection of the who at the time. And so basically people came together after the war effort to sort of discuss fundamental physics, and QED was a hot topic among other people. Lamp was there, Bethe was there, and Weisskopf was there. And so Lamp reported this famous measurement of the lamp shift, which he was able to do with some leftover equipment from the war. Not this piece, but some microwave technology was available. And so Weisskopf and Bethe discussed this lamp shift. And Weisskopf said, I know how to calculate it in a non-relativistic way, but I don't know how to do this relativistically. And I'm really stuck, and I've been working on this for years, discussing with many people. And so after Lamp reports this result, Bethe, on the way back, does this famous calculation where he comes up with this numerical value, 1 megacycle, yeah, And actually, this calculation that he does is not relativistic, but it's non-relativistic. And so Weisskopf found a very, very gentlemanly way to sort of congratulate Bethe for this calculation, but at the same time let him know that this was actually not something that he should have done without putting him as a co-author on the paper. Yeah. So that this was a topic, this land shift calculation, which sort of followed Weisskopf through his life. And I think, I mean, there are several letters where he basically says, I think, or interviews, I think I should have been acknowledged for this and should have gotten Nobel Prize. So that was some point of contention. All right, so after this conference, QED basically left from discussing the physics of the bound electron to discussing the physics of the free electron and high energy particles and so on. And so this was basically the birth of field theory, this conference. All right, but I want to go back to this Weisskopf-Wigner model. And so they have this statement in there that we should a priori expect an exponential decay. So why were they able to say that? And that is because of the situation that they were considering. Usually, when you look at an atom that decays, the line width of the decay is many orders of magnitude smaller than the transition frequency. And in this case, you can make this approximation and you come up, or the result is an exponential decay. There are other possibilities. You could have a situation where the coupling to the vacuum is extremely strong, such that the line width becomes comparable to the transition energy. Or you could have a gap in your spectrum, in which case you might be close to a spectral gap and you might be coupling to the edge of a band. That's a possibility. Or in the extreme case, your spectrum isn't a continuum but has a single frequency only. And of course, we all know what this is. This is just cavity QED, this limit. This limit is also pretty well discussed by now. So this case, this is photonic band gap materials, or QED in photonic wave band gap materials, waveguide QED. And then also here, this regime is now being explored. It's a strong coupling regime, so microwave systems are able to sort of look at this. In our simulation, we can basically tune here as we want. And so I want to basically show you results on where we detected, first of all, non-Markovian decay in the time domain for a strong coupling limit, and also a so-called atom-photon bound state. It's a bound state of excitations that exists in a band gap. Okay. So this is our system. These were people involved here, my students, Ludwig Grinner, Michael Stewart, Arturo Pasmini, and John Yukwan. And so this was published last year, experimental part, and also a little theory paper before. Okay, so what's the basic idea? How can we get spontaneous emission in a system like that? So the basic idea is very simple, and it goes back to this paper by De Vega, who was here at the program as well, yeah, Ines De Vega, and from the group of Ignacio Sirac. So the basic idea, I'm just paraphrasing this, yeah, so this is my own interpretation of the basic idea. The basic idea is this: an atom is nothing but a container in some way, which has a photon in it or doesn't. Yeah? Of course, it's wrong, it's internal energy, but one can just sort of naively think there's a photon sitting in here, and the photon is lured out by coupling to the vacuum. And so the atom, which has a photon in it, is in an excited state, and if it doesn't have the energy or the photon inside, it's in the ground state. And so the photon comes out with some energy, with some wavelengths, and these wavelengths and energy are related to the dispersion relation. Okay, so now we can do exactly the same thing again. We build an artificial atom which I'm labeling here a little bit differently. So it's a container. The container contains an excitation. The excitation is lured out through coupling to the vacuum, and then this container goes to the ground state, and the excitation comes out. Here, this excitation is a photon. In our case, it's a real atom. Now, there's a little bit of difference, which is, of course, the photon doesn't have rest mass. The atom has. But since the mass is basically conserved, and the only thing that we get is kinetic energy, the mass falls out of the problem. We can sort of ignore it. And so what you have, instead of the wavelengths of the light, is the De Broglie wavelengths of the atom as it comes out. And the dispersion relation is, of course, the dispersion relation of free space for a massive particle. So it looks a little bit different from there. But actually, when you are in a close to a band gap, in these photonic band gap materials, you have a quadratic dispersion relation. And then you have a direct correspondence. Yeah? So the photon in a photonic band gap material has an effective mass. In our case, the atom has a real mass, and so that comes in here. But once you see that, you see it's basically equivalent as soon as you can engineer a vacuum coupling.
So
does
this mean the energy is much higher?
The energies that we are dealing with here are just the kinetic energy of the atom. So this can be very small. It's on the order of a recoil energy. And the speeds, of course, here are the speed of light. And here it's on the order of recoil velocity, so millimeters per second. Which makes it, I will show this, which makes it much easier also to detect the momentum distribution of what comes out. Okay, so what are the ingredients? These are pretty standard ingredients. In atomic physics lab, we have an atom which has two internal states. It's in our case, rubidium, hyperfine states of the ground state here. We have coupling, so we can couple those two states using microwave radiation of a given strength and a given detuning. And then what we have is a state-dependent optical potential. This is an optical lattice, which shifts the energy spatially of one of the states while it does not affect the other one. And then in order to detect the results of measurements, we use the standard techniques of Stern-Gerlach separation and the magnetic field gradient. Yeah, so those two states actually they have different magnetic moments, so they can be separated. And we can also do time of flight techniques to see what momentum those states have. Okay. So the principle then is the following. You take these two states, I label them here red and blue. You couple them using microwave radiation. I'm going here in a rotating frame. So in this case, we have blue detuning. So you have, if you have an atom in the ground state and a microwave photon, the energy is higher than if you have an atom in the excited state and not the microwave photon. So you can shift this around as you want through the detuning. And in this case, yeah, you just have Rabi oscillations. Now you apply the state-dependent optical potential that confines one of the states where it does nothing to the other. And so you have a little shift here, zero-point energy that shifts maybe this little delta into capital delta. So that's the energy difference from here to here. But now the important point is these atoms here can have energy because they are not confined by the optical lattice, so they can move around and their energy is kinetic. And so you have a whole continuum or quasi-continuum of states available, of motional states. And one of them will be resonant with the state in your trap. And then if you apply coupling, you can bring the atom to leave or can get it to leave this trap and go into the continuum. And the Hamiltonian for this looks very similar here. You're just replacing the creation of a particle here by creation of a particle at momentum k. You have a momentum-dependent overlap of the wave functions. So that's a Frank Condon factor here. You get an additional phase evolution due to the energy or maybe the tuning to this energy difference from being resonant over here. And you have to sum up over all the modes. Now, if you look at this. You can also interpret this as follows, that you have an artificial atom whose excited state is a full well, the ground state is an empty well, and what comes out is this particle. Yeah, so this is this connection to the previous slide, and the Hamiltonian then is just, again, this Dirac or Weisskopf-Wigner Hamiltonian. Now, in terms of the vacuum coupling, in the real Hamiltonian, real Weisskopf-Wigner Hamiltonian, you're coupling the dipole transition matrix element to the electromagnetic field. Here, this coupling is your coupling of, which is induced with a microwave. Yeah. So this is the coupling strength given by the strength of the microwave, and then you have this Frank-Contin factor. So this piece and this piece, that makes you this coupling. But the idea is, this Hamiltonian has the same structure, and we can tune this coupling as we want. Okay, so how do we implement this? Well, it's an optical lattice system, so we basically start with an array of tubes. So think of this wells not being present, you have just the tubes. Yeah? Then we ramp up these tubes, we ramp up these wells within the tubes, make a mod insulator, and then blast most of the atoms out so that only we have only a few occupied sites. One is shown here. Typically, our degree of excitation is such that we have maybe less than half a particle per site on average.
So you don't select the atom you trap. It's random, the position of
the position is random. Yeah. So all I can tell you is statistical averages. Yeah. So on average, every second site is empty in our system.
Okay. So in your experiment, you're actually measuring the average of these emission on several sites.
Exactly. So several sites within the tubes and over many tubes. Yeah.
Okay.
So all we see is basically average over many realizations.
So it's not a single history. In the experiment, you're having itself an average of a different
kind. It would be very interesting to look at the single history, but yeah, we are not doing that.
Okay, fine.
Yeah. So in terms of the Hamiltonian that we have, it's not quite the Weisskopf-Wigner Hamiltonian because we have many emitters here. A site which is empty is a ground state emitter. So we have to sort of sum up over the sites as well. And so the Hamiltonian is basically a coupled version of the Weisskopf-Wigner Hamiltonian, where we have now site-dependent phases also. And that will be important when we compare the results of a simulation that we did with actual measurements.
Sorry to spoil again. Do you have a sort of super radiance kind of effects in this?
Not here. We kept the degree of excitation low.
It's very narrowly trapped.
It's narrowly trapped, but also we don't have population inversion in our system. Yeah. So less, we have more empty sites than full ones. So radiation, can be reabsorbed.
Right. Okay.
Okay. Let's look at what happens when we just start in the our lattice and turn on the microwave coupling. We can tune both the energy here. This is the tuning, yeah, the emission energy, and we can choose what coupling we have. And so the first case is in the Markovian regime, where the coupling is smaller than the transition energy. So this might visualize something like that. In this case, we see that there's an irreversible decay. It doesn't quite go to zero, so I get to this in a bit, but it's at least irreversible. We can also go to the non-Markovian regime, and the most extreme case is where you have basically zero emission energy and some coupling, yeah? Or where your line is so close to the zero energy that it basically gets chopped to a significant degree. And so what you see then is that the decay is not irreversible, but oscillatory. So in other words, the atom de-excites, so this emitter de-excites and then reabsorbs the radiation, and it does this a few times and sort of this damps out. Now there's a gray line here. I'm going to tell you about this in a second. This is our model for an isolated emitter. And what we see here is that the oscillations qualitatively look similar, but they're not quite what one would expect here.
Lisa.
Okay.
So this is our little model. It's basically based on previous works on photonic bandgap materials and also this paper by De Vega. And what we did is we just solved in 1D. We solved this this problem. One can nicely do this because I mean, when you do this for a optical system, you have a problem with the UV catastrophe, and you have to sort of define a maximum energy. You know, this, so you have to play some tricks. Here, high energies are naturally cut off by the fact that the Frank quantum factors for high energies or high momenta just goes to zero nicely, and one can solve these things analytically. And so what you see is that for large energies, emission energies at a given coupling strength, you have a exponential decay, and then here this is this oscillatory case. This is this gray line that I showed you, and so there's this transition region. Okay, now what are effects of the array? That's something we were not able to calculate, and so what we did is we took recourse to a very simple simulation where we said let's take three emitters. The center is excited, the neighbors are not, and let's just see what happens if you apply this Hamiltonian to the situation. And so you see here already we have, and I'm getting back to this, our decay isn't to zero. It ends up at some level. The gray line is what we would predict analytically, and so there's a clear mismatch. But once we take the neighbors into account in this simulation, you see that now we get something that looks similar to that. Yeah? So we are saturating. Also in this case, where we have this mismatch, if we do this numerical simulation, we see that now we are getting closer to our observation. So the enhancement of the oscillations is basically a result of presence of the neighbors.
But is it the hopping from one to the next?
There's of course, one can now. There's basically two mechanisms. One is you emit and you reabsorb. Yeah.
Okay.
The other one is you are directly tunneling. Yeah.
Okay. So even though you are the tunneling in the Mach insulator regime, you have still a residual finite tunneling.
The tunneling is not tunneling of the atom. The tunneling is mediated by, I will tell you about it, by the bound state. Yeah. So you have this bound state.
Then you can. Okay.
Yeah. So you. You can either spontaneously emit and reabsorb, or it is a resonant dipole-dipole interaction, basically, that is mediated by the presence of this bound state, even on the positive side.
Okay.
But it's definitely a sign that there's some reabsorption going on. Yeah. So this is similar to when you have an optically dense medium with a photon in there and many ground state atoms.
Right.
It will just diffuse around and sort of stay trapped for a while. Okay, so that's this. Now, in terms of when it has already been emitted, we can look at the momentum distribution of what has been emitted. And in this picture which I showed you, you see here results of time of flight spectrum, and that goes back to your question, do you track a single emitter or many? And so you see this is obviously many because we have two blobs and for one photon that of one atom that wouldn't work. So you see at the given energy, emission energy, you see these blobs at a certain distance away from where they would be if they had no kinetic energy. Okay, so we sum up over this. This gives you this line. Yeah? And then we can scan up and down here the emission energy, and you see that you nicely trace out this parabola. And so, of course, we plot this here as momentum, but what this really is, these are those BK amplitude squares. Yeah? So this is the amount of momentum that we have at certain momentum. You can also calculate this analytically. That's what we did here, or at least you can get the expression and solve numerically, and it fits pretty well. Okay, so basically we recover energy conservation, and so in terms of physics, there's no surprise. That energy, kinetic energy is conserved. But what we can also do is we can look at a given momentum, or at a given energy, and crank up the vacuum coupling. And so in our case, the lamp shift is given by this very simple expression. And so if we crank up the coupling, we should be able to see that there's some change in the excitation energy, and this is detected through a change of the energy of what comes out. And so you see it is a very small effect, but what you see is that those peaks moves closer together if you couple more strongly. And so the prediction here as a function of coupling strength is gray line, is this one here. We see qualitatively it fits, yeah, but it's actually stronger than one would expect. And it's actually not totally clear why. It's not that this would be a collective lamp shift, because we have no super radius in there. So it's this is still a topic that is kind of open, yeah, somehow, what the real interpretation is. But qualitatively, what we see is that if you crank up the vacuum coupling, those peaks move closer together. OK, now I artificially chopped off a region of this parabola. And if you don't chop this off, you see that actually also at negative energies, you have something that's emitted. Now, what is this? Negative energy in our system means that you are literally pulling the ground state below the excited state, such that when you're now emitting, you are basically absorbing energy. And by the way, this situation that we are here below, our dispersion relation is the same as in a photonic band gap, where you are below the continuum edge. And so it's relatively easy to get a finger physics argument what this is. So negative energy, or energy absorption, means negative energy comes out. Negative energy implies an imaginary momentum, and an imaginary momentum implies an evanescent wave. Yeah. So this, what we expect is that the radiation is unable to escape, but it's still, there is something there in the radiation field. And so one can calculate also the properties of this state here using Laplace transforms. And so what you see is that this state is made up of all the modes. They don't have their own phase evolution. They're all bound together. You have a binding energy. The binding energy is essentially the amount of detuning that you have below the continuum edge, modulo some AC Stark shift like dependence on the coupling strength.
This is an effective bound state.
It's a dynamic, you could say it's an effective bound state or a dynamic bound state. As soon as you turn off the microwave, it's gone. But it's really there, yeah. And so so we can now go to this regime of negative energy and just turn on the microwave, and what you see in the simulation or in our calculation for an isolated emitter is that yes, you have actually a little bit of wiggling still, yeah. And so the idea is that when you suddenly turn on the coupling, you have a transient effect in terms of the spectral width you get of the pulse exceeds basically the detuning below zero, or the energy below zero, so the coupling to the modes up there, and this radiation is able to escape. So it's a little bit as if you, it's maybe a bad example, but let's say you had a ball, and you're gently placing the ball into water and then pressing it under water. Yeah? So what you have is a dimple. But if you violently do this, you're emitting sound waves, those sound waves move away, and you still have the dimple underneath your ball. Yeah? And so that corresponds to the bound state, and then you have some transient shedding. So we can now look at the dynamics. So we look at negative energy, and indeed what you see is we get these oscillations. And actually now our isolated emitter model for this case actually fit pretty well. That was because we were so far below zero that there was no real coupling to neighbors. Okay, now something we can do in the experiment that's probably not easy to do for a real optical system is we can adiabatically prepare our system also. We don't have to turn on the microwave. coupling, a vacuum coupling, we can smoothly ramp it up. And so we have this situation. In this situation, if we have something that's missing here from the emitter, this is would be the sudden turn on. Yeah. But we can, as I just said, we can smoothly ramp it on. And in this case, we also see that we have something below this parabola, but it's actually a little bit less. Yeah. So there's a difference. And we can also look at the momentum distribution here. And in this case, for the sudden slam on, you see that we have a I'm summing up over this direction, we have some momentum distribution. In this case, we have another momentum distribution. Yeah. You can look at the difference. And actually, here we had a very, very lucky situation when we prepared our system. We prepared our system a little bit on a hill of a potential, which means that if something is not bound, it's able to ooze out here and run down the potential. And if we just wait long enough, we will be able to collect it then or see it as it has been accelerated. And actually, if you look at the difference here between the two curves, you see that this difference has a maximum somewhere. And actually, this maximum is exactly where we expect it in our measurements. So that's basically a direct sign that this difference here is due to the is the emitted piece. And then what's left here, this blue, is the bound state. Now we can also take our calculation and do a Fourier transform of this. And this is this red line for the parameters that we have. So it's more or less two signs that this is really a direct signs that this is a bound state. And this bound state, in our case, oozes out a little bit into the next emitter, but not a lot. The red piece is the atom as it sits in the lead as well. OK, so I come to the conclusion because I've run out of time. So you can see this as an open quantum system. So we start with a closed quantum system. It performs Fabi oscillations, OK? But we couple this to an environment, and we get this decay. Our environment is seen here. These are all those modes. Now what one can do with this system, you can vary the coupling strength, but you can also vary the properties of the environment. For example, the spectrum or the population. You can pre-populate it. In our case, it was vacuum, but it doesn't have to be vacuum. Just one example, that's something that we're doing right now, so varying the spectrum. In this case, we have emission into vacuum, but you can also emit into a band structure that's set by another lattice. And what you see here is that you clearly, I mean, this has to do with Frank-Cotton overlaps, but what you see here is there's a band gap. Yeah? And so you have in here, you have an in-gap bound state whose structure is actually not the same as the bound state out here. It has two blobs instead of one. Yeah, so it basically has a modulation in space. And also here, you have now a new energy scale, which is the width of the band. Yeah. And of course, it's clear that if the width of the band is small or the coupling is strong, that you have just Rabi oscillation. Rabi oscillations. In other words, this is also what you could call the cavity QED limit, where you have one state, effectively one state only. In the other case, for very weak coupling, you have Markovian decay, as before. And the question is then, what is in between? How do you understand this? I mean, there is a transition, but how does one quantitatively describe this? We don't know. I mean, it depends on the ratio here of omega and j, and you could sort of think of this as some kind of quantum Zeno effect, maybe, that you're driving here, yeah? And then you have some decay outside your system, but then there are other emitters, and so the system is actually quite complicated. Okay, so all of this, as I said, has to do with waveguide QED, and there's other systems, I should list them. So there's photonic systems, real photonic systems where you have an alligator, basically waveguide or periodically structured waveguide with atoms coupled to that. So we have atoms basically coupling to each other through bound states or through the light field. This is work from Jeff Kimball's group. You have other systems where you have transmon qubits that sit in microwave guides. This is from Andrew Haug at Princeton. So very similar systems in terms of the physics that's going on. But what distinguishes these systems from us is basically the Purcell factor, which describes how much do we couple to those structures compared to how much do we couple to the surroundings that are not controlled. For us, the Purcell factor is infinity. The only decay we have is into this channel. Here, the Purcell factors are maybe between 100 or 1 or something like that. Yeah, so much, much slower, much, much smaller. And so this direct non-Markovian oscillations are very hard to observe in these systems. So there has been lots of work recently from Max Planck Institute on possibilities that one can do with that one can look at with these systems. So as mentioned before, super subradiance effects, non-Markovian dynamics, maybe in combination with those even. Yes. What is non-Markovian superradiance? I have no idea, but I just know we can do this. If we can do superradiance, we can crank up the coupling and we will see modifications. There's this bound state which can mediate transport through a lattice, for example, or resonant dipole-dipole interaction, if you want to call it like that. So there's long-range interactions, many body phases, and you can play with the structure of the reservoir, the dimensionality, and so there's lots of possibilities to do interesting physics. Just one thing, one question. This bound state you can basically view as a quasi-particle. Yeah? So this is an atom which is surrounded by a virtual cloud of matter wave excitations. There's another system which we looked at a few years ago in this paper here, where we said, okay, let's take a condensate, a Bose-Einstein condensate, and put a particle in there, and we will form quasi-particles. These are polarons, where an atom is now surrounded by a virtual cloud of phonons. In this case, this leads to self-localization, or it reduces transport. In this case, it's just the opposite. Yeah? So it's quite funny that in this case, the quasi-particle promotes transport. In this case, it inhibits it. But one can now ask, is there a band structure associated to this? Yeah, I mean, this decays exponentially here rather than in a Gaussian way, so that complicates the description. One can ask, are there Bloch oscillations, for example, that one could use to probe this band structure? And then also, if you have a few of them, I mean, they still cannot be on the same side because on-site interaction kicks in between the red atoms. But you can ask, what are modifications to the mod insulating phase when you have this dressing from those bound states? And so this many-body physics, including this long-range tunnelings, this might actually also be something interesting to look at. Okay, and so with this, I'm definitely at the end of my time. Want to show in my group. Actually, I have to apologize for this picture. Yeah? So this picture was taken with one of my students, not there. So Arturo is in Ecuador now. This was Ludwig, Mike, and June. And then Alfonso joined recently. So he was not there yet when this nice picture was taken. But we are now together working on this exploration of more complicated vacua and possibly super radiance and so on. All this nice list is now basically on our list. All right, so that's it. Thank you.
It's good to have some questions, Randy.
I have a question. You described the emission from a mod insulator to a superfluid phase rather than just flat. Does it make any sense to look at transitions from different superfluid phases to different bands? In other words, do you expect super radiance in this kind of situation? In this case, you have a phase relation between atoms in different sites.
So the question of phase relationship is actually quite interesting, because you could imagine the following, that you start with a mod insulator up there, and then you turn on your coupling to the vacuum, and some coherence, because of bound state formation, will form, and then you will get a super radiant pulse. Yeah. But you could also start with a superfluid up there,
exactly.
Yeah, where you have already a phase.
Exactly.
And in this case, your super radiance will be much stronger.
Exactly.
Because the Because the coherence doesn't have to build up, it's already there.
But have you already started the sort of supercoherent emission from a supercooled phase?
That's something which is on our short-term list, yeah. I mean, it's a little bit complicated, and that's also what I put on this list, by the fact that radiation in our case is not... So photons don't interact with each other, right? But the atoms that have been emitted interact with each other, and that feeds back on the dynamics of the system. So it might be more complicated.
So you're not neglecting self-interaction.
We cannot neglect it.
You cannot, okay.
I mean, we neglected it in our models.
Yeah, sure.
But in reality, this is something one has to take into account.
Okay, thanks a lot.
So we're defining it like thank you.
All right, thank you.